The Kingmaker and Citizen K, two hard-hitting documentaries under the microscope, and the third instalment in the Jumanji franchise. This is called Jumanji: The Next Level. Arlene Hunt and Simon Marr have been to the cinema for us, and they're with me in studio now. We'll start with the Kingmaker, Arlene. Imelda Marcus, 3,000 pairs of shoes. Let's get that out of the way very quickly because it's such a ha-ha, funny moment.
How relatable she is.
Yeah, exactly that. Well, that's about all I think you're going to laugh at in this movie. What story is Imelda Marcus, or about Imelda Marcus, are we being told here?
It's interesting because initially I wasn't sure where... it's Laura Greenfield as director here, and I initially wasn't sure where she was going with this because she had... incredible access to Imelda Marcos, first of all, incredible access. These are one-on-one interviews. She's in Marcos's home, which is surrounded by great opulent wealth and full of, you know, servants. And obviously she's a woman of great means. And she's showing her all the photographs of her long, extensive career. You know.
For those who don't know the name Imelda Marcos, we should explain.
She was married to the 11th president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos.
Who left in disgrace in the 1980s.
They were basically exiled.
Yeah.
So she was a beauty queen, and she starts off with this sort of, you know, how she cries how the Philippines have fallen apart in later years, and you know how poor it is now. This is a very important line to remember. This
after the exile of her husband.
Yes, she's driving through the streets and she's doling out cash to all the little kids, the street kids, and she goes to see a cancer ward in this hospital, and she's very upset over how, you know, poor the country is and how, you know, all the things that used to be beautiful are no longer beautiful. And when you're watching all of this, you kind of, in one hand, you're almost agreeing with her because things have obviously gone terribly wrong. But it's only later in the film when you realise that this particular narcissistic woman is part of a dynasty that has siphoned off, estimated about $10 billion from this country's resources, and that she and her children and her family and the dynamic of them are the reason why this country is as poor as it is.
It's in the state that it's in. Let's listen to her. Where, I don't know if she realises even in this clip that the mask has already slipped. Let's listen to what she has to say about how difficult it was to get out of the Philippines back in the 1980s.
A few days before, there was a big reception that I had to wear some jewelry. Just as we were told to get into the helicopter, I saw a box of diapers for my grandchildren. So I put this jewelry in this box of diapers, diamonds in diapers. It saved us later on to pay the lawyers that cost millions.
The voice of Imelda Marcus there from the documentary The Kingmaker. Lauren Greenfield, obviously, Simon, won over the trust of Imelda Marcus and then just gave her the rope and off she went, and she didn't need to do anything other than put the microphone and the camera in front of her and Imelda Marcus delivered.
And that's it. It seems like when you're watching it at the start and you're thinking about the access, and the access that comes through it all the way through, and you think it must be ego. It has to be some sort. And you mentioned narcissism earlier a few minutes ago, but she opens up completely for all of this. And once, as you're watching the documentary, and probably for about the first 50 minutes as I was watching, I was thinking, why isn't she being challenged? You know, why is there nobody there as the foil?
You don't need to. She's going to hang herself
later on. But then you realise it would sound very strange. And you would not get half the access that you had if there was ever a question asked or if there was a challenge made. Whereas if she just left there to go on, and you can see that she's utterly deluded and makes... no connection at all, even at this distance. And even with family still involved in politics, she makes no connection between her activities and the poverty that's going on outside.
But most disturbing, possibly, within this story that's been told, Arlene, and I can see you're almost holding yourself from roaring about this, Ferdinand Bong Bong Marcos Jr., who is the son, of Ferdinand,
the original man,
He is now running for election, and she is right behind him.
She is, and
she's the kingmaker. He's the potential king.
So he's going to run because he is going to run to become vice president, because if he becomes vice president and then Duterte steps aside at some point, he will automatically go up into the position of president.
Duterte being the current,
yeah, the current president, who has a lot of issues of his own,
and very
well.
Much part of the populist movement.
Very much so. Very much so. He's a hardliner. He came down very hard on the reason he won is because he went very hard against the drug. There's a massive drug trade in the Philippines, and it's an open warfare for a lot of things. But this man is he has mobilized the police force into kind of his own personalized army, and no one can touch him, and no one can touch Imelda Marcos either. Like, she's, when she comes back from exile, this woman, like, she can generate so much press and so much devotion from the people who follow her, and they pass on to Bongbong.
Well, that kind of devotion that she seems to be able to achieve from those who are following her, to what extent, I mean, is she plausible? Because she puts across, as Arlene said earlier on, Simon, that this idea of being the kind of the mother, the caring mother, the maternal aspect of her. She's very worried about these poor people on the streets. How plausible is she when she says that? Or did you see right through it?
I think if you're at this distance away from the Philippines watching a documentary, it's very, very obvious, because
easy to see through it when you're looking from far away.
Even from the very, very start, there's a beautiful aerial sequence kind of at the start of the documentary, which looks down a lot of the shanties around Manila, you know, and then by the time you come into Imelda Marcos, she's going around and she's pointing at various paintings, you know, and various things that she's got. So to us at this distance, it seems very, very clear. But to others, I think it's possibly one of those things that you look at the population of the Philippines, a lot of people who are utterly without hope. And they look and they find...
There's an actual scene in it where a woman living in a shanty house with no running water, no electricity, is talking about how she kind of reveres Imelda Marcos. Yeah. Because, and Imelda Marcos herself says at one point as well, people need to have beauty, so they need to look at beauty. And she said, she had this line, and I made a note of it because it really struck me, and it struck me all the way through. She said, perception is real and the truth is not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, it's the Philippines version of fake news.
Yeah.
And she carries this the whole way through.
She does. But, and you can tell too that she is utterly convinced by this. This isn't a put on that she's doing.
Yeah.
She completely believes this, and she completely believes that her son is the future of the Philippines, and the only way
legacy
that this
is
can be
so
better.
Important to her. It's a legacy. It's the family name, it's legacy, it's dynastic, you know, power of constant.
So ultimately, what was the emotion coming out of this? Were you anger? Were you bemused?
I was horrified. I'll be honest. I was completely horrified. I was completely drawn and absorbed by it, but I was genuinely horrified. Horrified that she was able to do what she's able to do. Horrified that there's going to be a continuation of the Marcos line when highly corrupt and funded entirely by money off the back of all the poorest people in the region. Yeah.
And for you, Simon, it's something similar?
It's a pretty depressing story. That's the thing, as you watch it, like, you see, like, the poverty itself is depressing. The opulence that you see then makes it more depressing. But it's the fact that people without hope are really being cheated out of possibly having any hope in the future.
But I guess what's important to us in terms of a film review is how well does Lauren Greenfield tell the story? Stars from you, Simon.
I think she does this really, really well. I couldn't take my eyes off this story for a second. So this is a solid 4.
And what are you saying?
I give it 5 out of 5. It's hard to describe how this is a glimpse into a despotic sociopath. It's absolutely brilliant how she handled it and how much rope she gave her. It was incredible.
All right. Citizen K is our second film. You obviously enjoyed the first documentary.
Yes.
An equally engrossing theme here. It comes from Irish filmmaker Alex Gibney. Russian oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky is the subject of this particular film, waging his own personal war against modern-day Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin. Let's hear Alex Gibney himself kind of set up the nature of this film.
To hear Vladimir Putin tell it, Mikhail Khodorkovsky is a villain in a real-life gangster movie. But to Putin's opponents, Khodorkovsky's 10 years in a Siberian prison made him a hero for the cause of human rights and democracy. Now out of prison, Khodorkovsky is looking for a third act. That drew my interest at a time when we all seem haunted by Russia's role in the world. So I started a film about him.
Okay, Mikhail, anytime.
Well, I could go to Russia, he could not. He's wanted there for murder. So like so many stories about Russia these days, this one started in London.
Great dramatic music underneath there as well. Alex Gibney giving us the setup of Citizen K. And the Citizen K in question here, Arlene, is Mikhail Khodorkovsky.
Yeah.
So this is the third act that Alex Gibney is looking for, or that Horakowski is looking for.
Yeah,
what happened in the first act and the second act? The second act is in exile, which is where he is now in London. Yeah. First act is the important one, I guess.
Yes, it?
It
is. Enormously so. So the US, it's the late 80s, early 90s. The USSR is crumbling. They're losing or coming out of the communistic period and entering into a period of capitalism, which is completely... the Russians don't have any idea what capitalism is. It's not how they have ever operated. It's not how the Soviet Union was ever run.
Unless you're an oligarch.
Well, you see, oligarchs were created by the systemic movement from one thing to another because it opened up, it left a gap where all of a sudden Boris Yeltsin, who was the prime minister at the time, they ran into serious problems financially and they couldn't pay like your state wages. So the nurses weren't getting paid. The guys working in the oil fields weren't getting paid. The people that were like running schools, doctors, none of these people were getting paid. So these guys are able to come in and very, very quickly hand over fist, start making some serious cash and approach Boris Yeltsin almost directly and sort of say, well, look, we'll take over some of the burden that you're carrying, Mr. Yeltsin. from the bottom of their hearts. And so they snapped up all these state assets for really next to nothing. And they suddenly started making enormous sums of money. And that's how the oligarchs became from just being sort of really just sort of ragtag businessmen to these monumentally wealthy men.
So what kind of businesses then did Horakowski start off with in President Yeltsin's Russia?
His first business, and he said the one that made him his first million was a bank. He was essentially looked after.
A commercial bank.
So he looked
there
after.
You go.
He looked after the bank. He then got involved in it. I'm going to call it a scheme. And a scheme where, I suppose, with reasonably good intent, they were giving people a chance to buy shares in the future of Russia. You know, but this was done by kind of like a voucher system. But because he had the bank...
You were saying this with a lot of, it's all so obvious, but, you know, people buy government bonds all the time.
Oh, yes.
That's what we're talking about, really,
isn't it? I think the government bonds were designed originally to go to the people. You know, it's going to be that. But if he had snapped up a huge amount...
Enormous amounts of cash for these bonds. And he knew eventually, once he had enough bonds... that he would own he would have state control over certain things.
So he ended up as one of seven. There was just basically seven guys who ended up owning, you might as well say owning Russia.
Yeah.
So he built these vast, vast, vast fortunes and it's been described as the Wild West, is that everybody was there. There was a very short period of time when he got it. As same as happened in the Wild West, you got a small amount of people ended up owning everything and he was one of the seven who owned everything. He got it, and even as he talks about it, he's utterly amoral in the way that he talks about it.
Right.
It's not like he made a sudden discovery and said, look, I was a bad guy, now I'm a good guy. He said, I was a bad guy, you know, but now it so happens that circumstances have changed.
All right, yeah, because I was going to ask, was there a blinding moment or a road to Damascus moment for him? Because a total change, though, in terms of, he's very telegenic and he's aware of that. And he cleaned himself up very nice. I think he lost loads of weight, did he?
He did, yeah. He lost weight.
People compared him to kind of, you know, looks like a touch of Steve Jobs about him.
Yeah, for sure. And got his little steel glasses.
I just mean purely in terms of looks.
He's, you know, cleaned up very nicely. Got his little steel glasses. You know, he's very engaging when he talks. He's always got this like little twinkly little smile, you know, going. And like he's quite affable actually when he talks to the camera.
So he's not apologising for what he's done?
No, not even a little bit.
When did he get the boot out of Russia? What did he do that annoyed President Putin so much?
Well, the first thing he did was challenge Putin, which is I think he underestimated Putin. That's actually what I think. And I think one of the things that was dropped in this documentary, which I would have liked to have known more about, is Putin's rise to power. Because you know how Khodorkovsky rose to power, because you see it in the thing.
Yeah.
But Putin came up from, he was a middle management kind of guy. And so I think the oligarchs underestimated him enormously because they had all this money. They were surrounded by yes men themselves. He at the time owned Yukos, which is the biggest Russian oil company.
Yeah.
There was no one to touch them.
Yeah, and Putin had come from the KGB.
He was KGB.
Should they not have been a little bit wary of that background?
But these guys are the kind of guys that would think nothing of murdering, say, a Lord Mayor in a town somewhere. Because he challenged them, because he had laid off loads of workers in the time of crisis and basically left the town to starve. And then when the Lord Mayor challenged him about it, the Lord Mayor wound up dead.
Right, yeah.
So these are the kind of men...
An accident type of thing.
So they didn't see Putin. Putin was like a shark coming through the water. They didn't see him coming until Putin was right there. And by the time Putin had gathered up enough power... Yeah. Putin that we see today didn't spring from the ground like a Cabbage Patch doll.
Yeah, but this Putin then, clearly Khodorkovsky was annoying him for Khodorkovsky to have to get out of the country.
Yeah, well, he ended up being sent to prison, I think a 10-year sentence for embezzlement and all sorts of things. And there's a great piece in the documentary where they talk about the court, and he said, well, it looks like a court and it seems like a court, but it's not a court. You know, so he ends up, he's sent away for 10 years. He then decides, I've got to go into exile because he was worried for his life. At that stage, he had started really getting involved in the Open Russia movement. And this is where there's a real contrast in the movie, because while he's utterly unapologetic about all the other things he did while he's in Russia, he seems genuinely principled in his desires then to make Russia a better place.
Make
Russia great again.
Oh,
high five, sorry. Yeah. But the thing about it is, he's a weird combination. He's amoral, as Simon says, but he's also weirdly brave. Like, he's genuinely brave. Like, one of the guys, like, he was prepared to die in prison. He would go on hunger strikes, and what he would call an absolute hunger strike, would take no water whatsoever and no food to get what he wanted.
But isn't there also a kind of the other side? There's the very nice side of him, the Abramovich side. He's the guy who likes art, the guy who likes football, all this man of the people. Well,
Course. If you're that wealthy, you can easily put on whatever facade you want, really. Yeah. You just take it off your bespoke hangers.
So, do you think that Alex Gibney ultimately is presenting as the man with the facade, or is it a rounded portrait of Khodorkovsky?
I don't know. There's too many missing elements for me. I would really like to see that, like, what is the combination between him and Putin, because they were like two bulls in an arena going at each other, and you could see that, and he lost. He lost against Putin.
Khodorkovsky lost.
He lost. Yes, he was driven out of his own country.
He lost the first round, perhaps.
Oh, I think he lost it full stop, because what he doesn't seem to realise, which I thought was really interesting towards the end of the documentary, he's talking about how he needs to be back in Russia to effect change, and he really wants to go back and change things. But then they did a vox pop of people on the street in Russia, and people on the street in Russia like it the way it is, and they like Putin. They're proud of the fact that he is unbending and he's strong and he's this sort of domineering man. And it's interesting to me that for all of the knowledge that this man has in London and in exile and with everything
else, he doesn't know that.
He doesn't know the people anymore. He doesn't seem to understand what they want.
Stars out of five.
I gave it 4 out of 5. I thought it was really engrossing and really engaging.
And what are you saying overall, Simon?
I agree totally. I think 4 out of 5 is very good. I think it's the sort of film that, you know, as you watch it, or if you saw the trailer for it, you kind of think, this must be a drama. This is going to be one of those dramas where everybody smokes, wears fur coats and speaks in that accent.
Well, I mean, the music.
Everything about it, but it's a documentary you'll really want to see. So 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 for me. But by the way, it's 126 minutes long. That's 2 hours. Does it hold for that?
It does, because it's broken up into segments, you know, where he gains his money, the Siberian prison is an experience, and then the sort of the third, where he's trying to make change.
All right, let's move on then to our third film, Jumanji. The Next Level.
Slightly different.
Yeah, this isn't quite in the documentary vein of the other two movies. What was the previous level? What do we need to know about Jumanji to get to the next level?
Well, so Jumanji was originally out in 1995 and Robin Williams was in it. Yeah. And it's based on a series of books. But essentially what happens is real world people jump into a computer game. They take on various characters and they go on their quest or adventure or whatever it is. There was a spin-off to it in the early 2000s, but then it only really came back then with Dwayne Johnson and Jack Black and Karen Gillan and all those people became back involved then, 2017. It was huge. It was a massive movie, but I only watched it relatively recently and thought, okay, they've done what they can with this, but now they've
got to do more.
But now they've come back and they've come up with something more.
I suppose we should explain that there are people in real life who then have avatars in the game. So can you explain the difference between the two? Because we're going to hear a lot of voices in the clip I'm about to play.
Each human character in real life must be represented by an avatar in the game. But they can be whoever they need to be. So Spencer is
it's just Alex Wolff's character.
Alex Wolff, and his name is Spencer, and he goes into the game. In the original game, he was Smolder Bravestone.
It's Dwayne Johnson. So Alex Wolff becomes Dwayne.
No, in this one he doesn't. That's the weird thing. Okay. So he goes in and he's hoping to become Smaller race down again. But it turns out he doesn't. He ends up being a completely different character. And everybody else gets sucked into the game. And they're all of a sudden the characters that they were in the previous film, which I didn't see, by the way, they're now different characters. But also Danny Glover and Danny DeVito, who are in the house at the time when the game begins, they're also drawn back in and like put into avatars, and they're unwilling and unwitting, and they end up kind of in, and they're sort of the kind of comic foil.
I think the basic premise for this clip that we need to know is people go into the game and they're surprised at the avatar they become when they get there.
Surprise!
That's what I think is going on.
Would you look at me? I haven't looked like this since...
Never. You look like this never.
I think my eyes are a different color.
All of you is a different color.
Check this out. Strengths and weaknesses. Linguistics.
Oh, goodness.
Nunchucks. That's new.
Damn, that's a good list.
Weaknesses. Heat, sun, and sand. How is this guy a character in an adventure game? Man, it is hot out here.
I probably shouldn't ask you what's going on. What, is there a story here? Is there a plot line that will... No, there isn't. They go in, they become the Avatar characters... And what happens?
Well, they're going, like everything else, like every level, that's why it's the next level. So it's as if you're in a computer game and the quest is to do a thing. So the last time when they were just teenagers, you know, they had a quest that they had to go and do. In this one, they've got to go back in because Spence has already jumped back in. So they've gone back into this one. Let's call this level a rescue mission. But it's one of those things that
But while they're in there to do the rescue with Spencer, they also have to complete a mission because it's a video game. So they have to complete a mission. Yeah. So it's just Rory McCann from Game of Thrones is in it, and he is
he's the villain, is he? Yeah,
he's he's definitely the villain. He's Yorgon the Brutal.
That's worth it.
It is. But
it's worth it for that.
But it's one of those things, you know. I think the thing, having seen and enjoyed the last, I'd say quite recently, the bringing in the two old characters, bringing in Milo
Danny DeVito and Danny Glover,
is a really good move because it's one of those things that, you know, when you're playing a computer game, whether you're picking up, you know, you're picking up extra, you know, power packs or whatever it is, there has to be a different thing. When it's an old codger, Danny DeVito playing an old codger, trying to pick up these power packs and do various quests, it does add something else to it. But the fact that he's doing all of that through the body of Dwayne Johnson, through the mouth of Dwayne Johnson, is I thought, a really, really good stroke on
this. So it just sounds like a bit of fun. Is it mindless Christmas fun? You know, should you go?
The kids are going to love it, I think, because there's some really great clips in it, you know, where they're going across rope bridges with these absolutely terrifying mandel monkeys chasing them, and that's actually quite good. And Jorgen the Brutal is quite good. Okay. I just think children will enjoy it because it's that kind of ludicrous, high spirited, it's, you know, it's probably a great Christmas movie, you know, and I think kids will just go along and they'll have a hoot and the parents will
have a snooze because it's Christmas
time. Have a gin and tonic before they go in and they'll be fine.
So is Jorgen the Brutal, is he a guideline as to the nature of this movie, or is it much funnier than all of that?
It does have its moments of fun, and it's one of those films that if it took itself too seriously, or as the series took itself too seriously, it would be so utterly
There's
nonsensical.
There's a horse in it called Cyclone who's also a Bethany.
But I thoroughly enjoyed it. This child here thoroughly enjoyed it. You know,
so you enjoyed it. It's just fun, but don't get wrapped up in what's going on.
And I don't think anybody would think about a film like this too much. So 3.5 stars.
3.5. Yes. Okay. Jorgen the Brutal was your greatest moment.
Oh yeah, I'm going to give it 3 out of 5 because I try to think of it like what would kids like, and I think kids would get such a kick out of like the ostriches and the terrifying monkeys and stuff. So yeah, 3 out of 5.
And 3 out of 5. All right. That's Jumanji, The Next Level, The Kingmaker, and Citizen Kane. The other two rather different movies that we were speaking about this evening with Arlene Hunt and Simon Marr.